Welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, the latest on shares, markets and investments, now available on your Amazon Alexa.
Hello and welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, now also available on the UK Investor Magazine mobile app. For today's podcast, we're going to be taking a broad look at what's happening out there in markets. We're going to be looking at the investment environment in the UK. We're going to be touching on ISAs with the ISA season fast approaching, and we're also going to be touching on AI during today's conversation. And we're joined today for the first time on the UK Investor Magazine podcast kindly by Robinhood UK lead analyst Dan Lane. Dan, thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
Brilliant, thanks very much for having me.
So really looking forward to the conversation today, Dan. As I said, it's going to be a very broad conversation, touching on markets, looking at what is happening out there, as well as looking at ISAs and also getting stuck into the broader UK investment environment. But before we get stuck into it, as it's your first time on the podcast, please could you give us an introduction, first of all, to yourself, as well as Robinhood UK, please?
Yeah, of course. So Robinhood, we are a brokerage platform that you can get on your wherever you get your apps. Lovely, sleek interface. And we've got 27 million customers in the US who have already grown to love the product. And we're now in the UK, so offering a wide range of products and services. Most recently launching our ISA, which has been really exciting. And then within Robinhood, I'm in charge of all the content and analysis. There's a page on our website all about learning. So whether you're a newbie or you just want to keep up with the markets, that's the place for you.
We're going to be getting stuck into some of your analysis today. And actually, that's, I think, where we'll start and take a look, if we may, at what's happening out there on the market. I mean, as we were saying before we started recording, looking at equities at this point in time, anything that we say now is likely to have changed by the time this is published, given what's happening out there in the world. But of course, the dominant theme at the moment, Dan, is the conflict in the Middle East. Very difficult to read it on a day-to-day basis, very difficult to know how it's going to play out. But from where you're sitting and your perspective, when you're looking at the equity markets at this point in time, of course, we've had a huge sell-off. If you take maybe a bit of a medium-term view, longer-term view, how do you see it playing out for markets at this point in time in relation to what's happening in the Middle East?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. It's changing. I mean, I even thought I was being conservative before we started by saying morning to afternoon, but you were right in saying it's minute by minute. So it's first thing up to date on. And I should say, you know, I am part of this conversation, but, you know, Robinhood doesn't give financial advice. My compliance department is very heavy on me saying, you know, capital is at risk when we're all investing. I think everyone's happy now that we said that, are we? Yes, we're good. And in terms of the actual market itself, I think certainly what I'm seeing, if we zoom out, I'm seeing that, you know, on one hand, there's this fear of missing out if there's a de-escalation rally, and we've seen kind of green shoots of that, which is then completely kind of contradicted by, you know, the risk of staying heavily invested if the situation kind of deteriorates. So we're caught between a rock and a hard place here, right? It's difficult to see how your psyche is going to be completely confident in whatever you're doing as an investor. For me, I think, taking a step back, what's the most unanticipated response? Okay, well, it's probably been this kind of looking for safety in the tech sector, because, you know, it wasn't that long ago that everyone's getting super, super nervous about tech stocks and about the CapEx spending there. Commodities had been in vogue, you know, you were just watching gold like shoot up the page. But, you know, prospect of higher inflation, higher rates, that scuppered all of that. And then, you know, coupled with this, investors looking to these so-called halo assets, you know, heavy assets, low obsolescence. In essence, what investors have been looking for is profit centers. And then that brings in these hyperscalers, which, you know, have money to chuck around. So for me, that's been the most surprising thing, really, just how quickly you can be out in the cold as a stock and then right back in there. And I just don't think that's finished. I don't think we're done seeing that kind of look for wherever, you know, where can I see some sort of perceived safety? I don't think we're done with this, actually. I think we're still going to see investors looking for kind of safety wherever they can. The tech one has been a real reversal that's caught my eye. But I mean, I think that what we're seeing as well is people just unwilling to take risk and unwilling to kind of go into the market with any kind of sizable risk at the minute. Certainly what we're seeing within Robinhood customer trends is they're sticking to their knitting and they're backing the tech names that they see powering the AI infrastructure build out that started before this, and, you know, it's likely to continue after all of the geopolitics as well. So what are some of the names we're seeing? You know, Micron, Nvidia, Mara. These are just some of the names we see consistent appetite for. And these are, you know, in the monthly articles that I do about the most popular stocks. We saw them at the end of last year, start of this year. and then after the conflict started as well. So that kind of consistent attitude towards these tech names is what we're seeing.
Yes, it's really interesting actually, Dan, because as you mentioned, you know, before the conflict in the Middle East, there were some questions around AI. That was one of the big themes at the beginning of the year, and it rumbled on talking about the AI infrastructure. But as soon as the attacks happened in the Middle East, it all of a sudden became a safe haven. And it's really interesting there, you know, noting that your customers are sticking to their knitting and probably taking that view of, okay, maybe things aren't going to be good in the next couple of months, possibly, but this is a story for the next 3 to 5 years and stuck with those. And they have really proved a safe haven then. I'm just looking at the share price here of Nvidia. Very little change to where it was at the end of February. So that's an interesting point there. One of the things that, you know, of course, what's happening with the Middle East is always going through the roof, you know, above $100 as we speak. Who knows where that will be next week? But the knock-on effect is interest rates, what that's going to mean for interest rates going forward. How do you think people should be thinking about interest rates in the Middle East conflict? You know, is it something that is actually going to be a potential risk? Are we going to see central banks hiking rates and really upset the equity markets? Or do you see them looking through it and thinking, okay, we're going to see a short-term blip here and then it evens out, and that obviously plays out into equity thinking as well if they're looking at 6-12 months down the line?
Yeah, it is a real mix at the minute of kind of ultra near-term thinking and then people kind of pricing this out over the next couple of years. It is funny because probably a bit like yourself, you're just reading research every day. Some people saying, you know, we're expecting a halt to the cut trajectory in the UK, maybe even, you know, 2 or 3 hikes by the end of the year. And then you've got people saying, you know, that's preposterous that, you know, this will all be done and dusted and we'll get another cut before Christmas. So I think we have to accept that we just don't know how this is going to feed into the inflation picture until it does. And I think the broadest measure of that is if we see the oil price kind of stay higher and remain at these levels for 2 to 3 months, really, that's when we can start to say, okay, well, feasibly this is being factored into inflation figures, which then has, you know, knock-on effect for interest rates. If there's no resolution soon, we might start to price the rate hikes there rather than cuts. But the truth is we just don't know yet. There's lots of predictions and projections. And I think the narrative is moving so quickly that the temptation is to follow suit in your portfolio. But then the real danger is you end up chasing the story and you're jumping in and out of investments a little bit like, you know, changing line at the supermarket. You know, as soon as you jump into the other line, you see the original one start the motor. So I think it's worth taking a step back here and making sure our portfolios are set up for the long term so that we're not making those annoying little short-term positions that we might regret.
Exactly. That can always be the annoying thing, isn't it? You know, if you panic in the short term, it can have really long-term consequences for your portfolio. That's a very good point that you make there, Dan. So as I said, this is going to be a broad conversation. So we're going to pivot now on to the UK investing environment. And it's really interesting. It's going to be really interesting to get your perspective, Dan, because of course, Robinhood, established in the United States, you know, is a platform there which really brought a lot of people that maybe weren't involved in the markets previously with fractional shares and various other products on your platform. So it's going to be really interesting to talk about the differences that you see and you know, your company sees, you know, in the differences in the culture here in the UK compared to the United States. You know, there's, you know, the government is trying to do a lot at this point in time to encourage people to invest and put money into the markets as opposed to holding it in cash. So from where you're sitting and the comparisons that you can make from the data that you probably have at your disposal, do you see evidence of a cultural problem when it comes to investing in the UK? And how does you know, investing in the UK and the people involved and the investments that they're making differ to, you know, similar demographics in the United States?
I mean, there's market differences here. I think you've got two sides to this as well. You've got like a cultural side to it, and then you've got an industry side and how they meet and how they influence how the retail investor participates in the market. I think, so looking at our data, you've got around half of US households own stocks directly, and then that moves to just kind of 20% in British households. So that's a big difference. Looking at it, you kind of look at the US, the UK, and you say, well, actually, the UK market looks like the US did 10 years ago. And there's a big addressable, untapped market in the UK. And I think there's behavior there. We're naturally a little bit more standoffish, a little bit more risk averse. Even when UK investors do invest, you know, we like those dividend stocks. We don't go for those big growth stocks. Even the market's different and set up for that as well. So that's kind of, you've got this cultural aspect of it. But then you've got how the industry has been set up to serve UK investors. And, you know, traditional brokerages always kind of charged high fees, and maybe it hasn't been the cleanest experience about, you know, accessibility. And to be honest, that's kind of why we have an ambition to change all of that. You know, we've been really encouraged by people really enjoying the Robinhood experience. It's a very, very simple app to use. It's quite a nice way to have it in your pocket and understand things very readily. And also, we like to think that our fees are one of the most competitive out there. So you've got this difference being that the US has always been kind of innovative and drawing people in. You've got these like dinner table conversations around stocks, whereas we know that actually investing has been seen as some sort of like reward for being rich in the UK and not really a path to get there. So there's a lot to change. And I think that's kind of really why we wanted to be here, to reshape that investment culture in the UK.
That's a really interesting point that you've just made there. In the UK, that stocks, you know, are seen as something for people that are already rich, but not seen as a way to grow your wealth associated with already having that wealth. That's a really good point that you've made there. Well, I think one of the issues in the UK is the younger generations maybe aren't as financially savvy as previous generations, and we'll get onto that in a little bit more detail. You know, of course, participation in the equity markets by younger people, you know, that does secure the future of the equity markets. How have you seen trends among younger people change over the last 10 to 15 years? And what still needs to be done to encourage more younger people to invest?
Yeah, I mean, listen, this is the big thing. This is what we're all trying to answer here. I think, I mean, to be honest, I started investing about 15 years ago. And what I saw was kind of inaccessible platforms with very high fees that, you know, just from personal experience, if I'm paying quite a high commission fee to invest my, what did I have back then, £100, £200 a month? I then have to make back 10%, 20% to actually make that, you know, worth doing. So it's not really any surprise to me that people thought that this was a reward for being rich, because, you know, to pay those fees, I needed to be investing maybe £2,000-£3,000 a month, which was completely unthinkable back then, which was probably why I was in cash quite a lot. Fast forward to today, and you've got accessibility is a big thing. If I want to buy one of those big shares and one of the very expensive shares, I can do that through fractional shares. You know, we offer that on Robinhood. I don't need to save up to buy one of those shares and then like hover over it until I can buy another one. I can just buy a fraction of it. So that's a massive, we shouldn't underestimate how important that is for young people to actually start whenever they are young. I think, you know, I would talk up my own book, but actually education in kind of jargon-free language is something that I never got whenever I started 10, 15 years ago. And that's kind of what I'm really passionate about, what I offer and what I try to offer every day on our site. On a tangent there, you know, I used to work for companies writing for pension funds and institutions, and it was always about how much Latin you could squeeze in there to make yourself sound more intelligent. And, you know, no, Dan, that doc's 8 pages, it needs to be 25 to make it look really, really padded out. It was just nonsense, wasn't it? And we try and do things like 500 words, you'll get a push notification. Does it help you? We think it does. You know, really, really kind of low lift, snackable content. And then the product that kind of helps you put any ideas that you have into action there. But it's about consistency, right? It's not just about put someone on a training course and then there you go for 30 years. It's about constantly letting people know that this is not something that's beyond you. This was created for you. You know, we think that the stock market has tremendous ability to help with long-term wealth creation, and you should just keep on learning. You know, that's kind of where we are. And that's, I certainly didn't have that information 15 years ago, and I'm really pleased that we're able to offer it now.
Yeah, I think there has been in the past, going back to the point that we made previously about, you know, there being perceptions of who the stock market is for. You know, I think there has been in the past barriers to entry by the information that people consume and they have available to them. So anything can do to make it simpler will bring more people into the market, and that will help everybody that invests in UK stocks over time. One of the channels, of course, for people investing in the UK is the stocks and shares. ISAs, cash ISAs, of course, have been a topic of discussion around the government. We'll get onto that a little bit later on. But there's still a lot of people that aren't using their ISA allowance as maybe they should be. Why do you think that is, Dan?
Oh, yeah, isn't it the most frustrating thing? And I think anyone who's in the industry and has sat around kind of a a Christmas dinner and talked about it, and family's been like, yeah, I don't know whether I should use this or not. You're kind of tearing your hair out, you know, while you're trying to gulp down some turkey. But okay, I mean, look at the structural reasons here. I think as an industry, we think we have to kind of look at ourselves a little bit and say, we've kind of touted the tax efficiencies of these accounts and then said, great, here we are, come find us. And actually over the years, that's not been a great way to be, because first of all, you know, some of the research we see, people just don't understand what tax efficiency means. And actually it sounds like a big jargon filled, I mean, the word tax, especially in my word, puts everyone off. So there's a way that we describe these products that puts people off. But actually, let's think about it as people who maybe have never been in this industry. It kind of maybe sounds like a product that your money's locked up, like it would be in a pension. You can't really access it. Certainly in our research, we know that people have that misconception. Some people think that they don't have enough money to invest. Again, we talked about, you know, people think that investing in an ISA is some sort of reward for already being rich. And actually, we did some research in a Freedom to Invest report that we did. People thought that you needed around $2,500 to just get going. I mean, that's a massive misunderstanding. And that's why people aren't using that allowance. People also misunderstand that £20,000 allowance as I need £20,000 to get going. So there's a lot of half understandings that are probably even more dangerous. You know, that they have that figure in their head and they think, well, I'll get going when I have that. But actually, there are so many things that we can do to just aid understanding. And again, it's what we try and do just regularly through, you know, Saturday morning emails on the app and bringing people little snackable chunks, as opposed to sit down and I'm going to teach you all about ISAs.
Yes, makes very good points there. There are a lot of misconceptions out there about ISAs, and it probably does put people off. And I think that comes down to, well, I mean, you know, anyone following it will see what's happening out there. You know, they're trying to change it. They're trying to encouraging people, but there's, you know, there seems to be, from the powers that be over the last 5 to 10 years, has been a real emphasis on risk and you know, protecting consumers and retail investors. But it's actually probably had the opposite effect by putting people off and meaning that they haven't taken part in some of the equity rallies that we've seen, and you know, had their cash sitting there.
Yeah.
So that takes us quite nicely on to the government's approach to ISAs. There have been some proposed changes for ISAs. How do you rate that, Dan? Do you think it will actually make a difference?
Yeah, well, I mean, listen, isn't it great that we're having these conversations? I think over the years, there's been these conversations and they kind of petered out. And I think, to be honest, we really welcome the Chancellor's reforms, the ISAs, and anything that makes it simpler and gives us a simpler view of the account and makes it easier for people to invest and support them along the way. Hey, you know, that's always going to get our vote. I think if you take a step back, there are broader changes that are needed to boost retail investment in the UK. You know, we're very happy to be part of that retail investment campaign. And I think there's little things that need to come from multiple angles. We're very guilty of, you know, looking at the latest headline and saying, well, that's not going to be the silver bullet, let's not do it. When actually there needs to be, we need to be spinning plates all over the show just to really encourage people. It's really positive there's going to be a marketing campaign. Is it going to change absolutely everything? Probably not. But that's not what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to be one spoke in a much larger plan. I think changing the ISA allowances, yeah, it might make a difference, it might not. But again, this is one more step along the way. And anything that kind of helps people make more informed investment decisions and helps the industry engage a little bit as well. If this isn't just on the consumer, the industry has to change and look at themselves as well. So, yeah, we think it's really positive. And if it really changes behaviour, we're all for it.
Fantastic. So last point here on the UK investment environment, looking at financial education from where you're sitting, Dan, and you know, of course, you've outlined the services that you have on offer there to encourage people. But what do you see as the biggest barrier at this point in time, which is stopping people from getting involved in the stock markets?
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about the cost misperception there. That's a huge one. But actually, I mean, it's one that rings true a little bit more to me is just this confidence, you know, and it's kind of unquantifiable a lot of the time. And it is a cultural thing. A lot of the research that we've done points to where this confidence barrier comes from and where it exists most readily. And I think in the past, we've been guilty of just saying, you know, men take too much risk, women don't take enough risk. And we challenged that. We had a look at that, actually. And we find that, you know, women are 50% more likely than men to say they don't invest because they lack confidence. Now, there's a lot in there, because I know a lot of men who shouldn't be investing because they have too much confidence and that you're taking outsized risk. So actually that confidence isn't just that men are doing it and getting everything right. It's men are doing it and just maybe being overconfident, whereas women are taking a much more, maybe a risk off or risk averse attitude. But when they do come around to it, have a lot more positive behaviors. So what I think what we really want to be doing is talking to people about that confidence. Why are you not confident? And actually, the person who's throwing money at any asset they can see, hang on, what's fueling that overconfidence as well? And again, what we find is that if you're overconfident and you make a mistake and lose some money, that might put you off investing for life. So overconfident is as great a barrier as underconfidence. And this is where knowledge, education, a little bit of an interest in the market and keeping up with and being able to relate current events to what's happening in your portfolio is so important.
Indeed. So we're going to move on now, Dan, and talk about AI, because of course, you know, that's changing the entire world and it's of course changing the investment landscape. So there's obviously benefits of using AI in your investment process, but of course there's going to be some dangers to it as well. But from where you're sitting and the work that you do, how has it changed versus 5 years ago, and what can a retail investor do now by using AI, which is simply they simply couldn't do 5 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, listen, it frustrates me. It makes me a little bit annoyed that I'm not starting the industry right now. If I cast my mind back, even if I go back to 15 years ago, I remember going in and sitting on my desk as a young analyst. There was a stack of papers, probably the height up to my knees, and there were people just saying, "Yep, there's your work for today." At on a very simple level, people can just ask AI tools to kind of summarize things for them, find things out for them, not necessarily perform the actions for them, but hey, give us a little update on this and what's happened and how I can respond to this in the market. That is a massive advantage. You know, we really didn't have this 5 years ago. You know, in a previous job, I was helping with an AI fund that was trying to spot where all of these opportunities were going to come from. And this was really one of them, helping the retail investor understand what the market is like. So we're saying things like, you know, offering near real-time insights is so valuable. We've got a really cool product at Robinhood called Cortex Digests. And when you're watching an earnings call, you're just watching this digest, doing what it says on the tin, just like breaking down and explaining what's happening. I use it whenever I'm on the NVIDIA calls. And it's just updating, telling you what Jensen Huang's talking about, some of the big takeaways. That's huge. You know, even the professionals didn't have this 5 years ago. So I love how this is really broadening the playing field. You're getting stuff at pretty much the same time as the pros. Nothing is unintelligible. And if it is, hey, there's an AI for that. And suddenly you've got this level playing field, which I just think is so positive for retail.
So you mentioned one application there, Dan, but you know, are there any other ones that excite you in terms of AI tools that retail investors can use?
Yeah, I mean, the Cortex products that I was talking about, we have a simple product in the UK. We're steadily, you know, getting help from our US team. But essentially, the tools that we have that are using generative AI to summarize, you know, why a particular stock might be moving and then delivering it to you in straightforward language, you know, that's super interesting for me. The important point there is that where are these responses coming from? How is this being sourced? And what we've done is, you know, we've got these high quality trusted inputs, real-time market data, analyst reports, research reports, that actually a lot of the Wall Street firms are using anyway. And this is across the entire Robinhood experience. So I think, you know, watch this space, but I think we're going to see a lot more of integration of AI tools into specifically our experience. I'm not really seeing this in the marketplace just yet. I'm seeing fits and starts, but nothing that's all encompassing or that's really that helpful in the same way that I access Cortex Digests.
I'm going to finish off now, Dan, by looking at UK companies specifically. And, you know, fairly broad question here, just to get your feeling on your perceptions of what's happening out there. Are you generally quite optimistic or pessimistic about UK listed companies at the moment?
Well, you see, Jonathan, this is why I said up top that I am not responsible for any advice or anything, because this is where I am so passionate, right? I'm so optimistic on UK equities from a personal point of view. And I kind of always have been. People in the office have always, you know, kind of made fun of me for being the perma bull. But I really am. I think I'm optimistic both from a setup point of view and looking at the drivers already fueling UK companies. I think you only have to look at last year. The sectors that were really out of fashion in the scrabble for tech over COVID, you know, they were forgotten about, and actually people were making fun of the FTSE. And then the FTSE 100 returns 22%, right? These are the companies that were meant to be dead and buried. The good thing is that even after that rally, I still see, you know, there's a massive discount persists. And the funny thing is that even if UK investors won't buy UK assets, well, US private equity will. We saw huge debt, like hefty premiums. And UK investors are kind of scratching their heads while, you know, these big funds are coming in and being like, well, yeah, do you know, I think the average premium on FTSE 250 takeout last year was like 30, 40%. And if they're saying, well, hey, if you don't want it, we will. And we'll pay 30% above asking. And we're still seeing value. So that's crazy to me. And then in the background, you've still got this great string of, you know, buyback activity, dividends are in rude health. And whenever we talk about the world's panicking and thinking, quick, what are these companies that have cash to hand? Well, that's a lot of UK companies you're talking about there. So the setup is positive for me. And then in the background, you've got these really cash generative, positive UK stories on the ground.
I mean, I think it goes back to some of the discussions that we had earlier on in the podcast that, you know, there's so many companies out there which are undervalued. And you're having overseas, in most cases, you know, US private equity funds, as you say, coming in and saying, well, you know, if you won't buy it, we will. And I think that probably comes back to some of the points that we made earlier on about there only being 20% of households in the UK owning shares directly. You know, not having that liquidity in the market is probably one of the key driving forces of those stocks being undervalued in the first place. So that's really interesting. So one last point here to finish off with now, Dan. You know, as you say, big fan of the UK markets. If you had fresh cash at this point in time to put to work in the UK market, where would you be putting it?
I'm conscious there's probably going to be compliance eyes glaring at me, so I won't go that far. But I'll tell you what I will say. One area I'm particularly interested in is the mid and small cap space. I think there's a disconnect between what people are understanding has happened to balance sheets there and what is the actual reality. I think so. Just to explain what I mean there, if rates do kind of resume this downward trend and inflation doesn't hinder domestic consumption in the second half of this year, I think you start to see a little bit of relief in those the hardest hit areas, which tend to be the small and mid cap space. Smaller companies especially have already been hit hard by higher rates. But actually, what's being ignored in my eyes has been a lot of them shored up their balance sheets over COVID. They had to. They had to right size those businesses, pay down a lot of debt. And that tends to be the main drag when rates rise. People think, okay, well, the indebtedness over indexes in smaller companies, so we're just going to sell smaller and just stick to the big guns. Actually, a lot of those are in really, really good health, and they already were coming into this kind of geopolitical malaise that we're in right now. So there's a lot of strong balance sheets in mid and small. And when you factor in the fact that, you know, valuations have come down probably unfairly in a lot of cases, that's the area that I'm really looking at.
Dan, thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
Excellent. Really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me on.
And thank you very much to everyone for listening. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Please do share the podcast, and we really value any reviews and comments you leave us in your chosen podcast player. The views presented by the hosts and guests of the UK Investor Magazine podcast are in no way investment advice, and please remember, all investment involves risk.